The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What is Tourette's syndrome?
Tourette's syndrome is a neurological disorder that, regardless of what you'll hear or see on TV, where it's generally just described as the uncontrollable screaming of obscenities, at its most simple, Tourette's syndrome makes people either move involuntarily or vocalize involuntarily, so it's just sounds and movements that you'd rather not make. This has to do with genetics and chemicals in the brain. The race is kind of on for which genes are responsible, but that kind of brings us up to speed. You know, that's the least you need to know about it.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that's all about the literature of the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Josh Hanagarney about his book titled The World's Strongest Librarian, a memoir of Tourette's, faith, strength, and the power of family. As the title of your book indicates, you are very strong, the result of many years of training. So to explain how and why you started lifting weights, I'd like you to read a couple pages that describe the first time you went to the gym with your dad. This was the day after you'd been to a medical appointment with discouraging results.
Okay. The next day, Dad walked through the living room, saw me lying on the couch half awake, and nudged me with his boot. "Get up. Get some shorts. Get in the truck. We're going to the gym." I reached for a ready-made excuse. The bag was empty. We drove to town. "Why do I have to do this?" "You don't have to." He turned on the stereo and fired up a Dwight Yoakam tape that my mom hated. "But you need to, and so you'll do it." "I don't want to." "Then you shouldn't have gotten in the truck, smart guy." "I'm smart." "Then you'll admit that the chances of that couch you're so in love with driving itself down the road with you laying on it are pretty poor, right?" "Lying." "What?" "Lying on the couch, not laying." He whistled. "Wow, is it nice, being a genius?" "It looks nice. Thanks for the correction. I'll turn around and tell your mom that she's got nothing to worry about." All I meant was that if you'd stayed on the couch, you wouldn't be in the truck. "Okay." "No, not okay. You're going to the gym with me. I think this will be good for you." "Why?" "Because I've been depressed before. I know some things. But listen, can I ask you a question?" "Yeah." "Is there anyone you look up to? I'm serious now. No jokes." "I don't know," I said. "What good would it do to say I looked up to my dad, or my grandpa, or the prophet, or Pee Wee Herman, for that matter?" "Well," Dad said, "you've got to find someone to follow. Do you know who that is?"
"You?"
"I wish, but no, it's you. You have zero confidence."
"Yes, I do."
"Yes, you have zero confidence. No, I know that's not what you meant, but no, you don't. And do you know how I know?" "Because you're in touch with Navajo spirits." He exhaled hard through his nose. "Do you ever get tired of being so funny? It's a nice little smokescreen, but I know you. Confident people do stuff. They get stuff done. They make things, even if it's just making money. You know what you're making? It doesn't matter. You're making our couch sag. That's about it. You're making your mom sad because you're not trying. You're making your siblings miserable because you're acting like you're miserable." "I am. I'm depressed and on a bunch of drugs. I want to take more of them every day just to feel different." "This isn't depression, and that's not their fault. But I don't want to fight. I think what we're about to do is going to give you a way to make some progress. There's nothing important about lifting weights. There's nothing insignificant about progress. Let's just give it a try." Dad had been lifting inconsistently for most of his adult life. He'd usually go until he injured himself showing off, take a couple dozen months off, wait for New Year's to roll around, and then decide that this would be the year he got his bench up to 350. He once hurt himself in a Denver sporting goods store by bench pressing for the Broncos cheerleaders, who were duly impressed as my mom let him lean on her for support as they exited. The gym parking lot contained few cars. Nothing about it screamed salvation or remake yourself, except for the poster on the wall, a man in a black string tank top doing curls under the words, "Remake yourself." My dad scanned his card. "And he needs a guest pass," he told an old guy behind the counter, "and he'll need one of those slinky tank tops from that poster he's looking at." "Don't sell them," said the guy. There were four other people there. Two peppy women in spandex hopped up and down while holding tiny dumbbells under their chins in both hands, as if they were trying to fill chalices with the sweat of their labors. "Wow, they're really laying it all on the line, aren't they?" whispered my dad. "This place gets some weird customers." A short guy wearing a fearsome black bandana stalked before the wall-length mirrors. He yanked up the hem of one leg of his Daisy Duke denim shorts and flexed his quadriceps in the mirror. He nodded. He had an enormous tattoo on his calf. "We need to get you some little shorts like that," said my dad. "Man, you're skinny. Let's get started." "Okay, how?" He led me over to the rack of free weights. "Just find a couple of dumbbells that you can put over your head and start pressing them until you can't. Let's start there. I'd like to see your shoulders get a little bigger." "Why?" "I'll tell you later. I'm going to go bench. Now lift." I tested a few dumbbells and settled on a pair of 45-pounders. I could only manage a couple of consecutive overhead presses before I got wobbly and pulled out of alignment. I felt silly. But as I began to fatigue, the other people faded. There was just me and my body. My stupid, thin, Benedict Arnold of a body. I could focus on getting the movements right, or I could worry about everyone else. I focused on the details.
We should tell people that you are very tall, 6'7". And at that point in your life, you were skinny because you were 20?
Yeah, that was 20 years old.
So how does focusing on details help you with Tourette's? Because not only in this training, but in some training that you did a few years later, that seemed to be really important.
Well, at the core of it, just focusing on anything else can help because sometimes the Tourette's is just all I can see because of the way my body jerks so badly and the kind of physical and vocal tics I have are very invasive. So if I can focus on anything, it's a good thing for me. Now, for the weights, it just gave me something to focus on. I mean, if anybody's been in the gym for very long, your technique matters, and the stronger you get, the little things start to matter more. It just gave me something specific to pay attention to, and it gave me a type of progress I could actually measure. And anytime I can forget about what's happening in my body, that's always a good thing for me. It just happened that the weights were one of the things that, in hindsight, I learned it was the only time I actually felt like I had complete control of my body. Does that help?
Yes. When I read about the involuntary noises that happen with Tourette's, sometimes very loud noises, I was amazed that you went to work in a library, which is a place we usually associate with silence. So what happened when you applied for the job and told them you had Tourette's?
Well, nothing really happened because I can stifle it a little bit if I need to. And when I'm out in public, I need to. So when I'm at the library working, most of the library patrons who know I have Tourette's, they would probably tell you, "Yeah, he's really twitchy," versus "he's really noisy." Because at work, in order for me to be there and not ruin everybody else's time at the library, I have to stifle it a little bit. And stifling the vocal tics tends to mean it balances out by the physical tics getting bigger. This can be anything from me waving my arms to slapping my face to scratching myself, down to very small things like blinking too much or curling my toes, some things that nobody else can see. And the reason I chose the library, other than a lot of reasons, you know, that I just love libraries, was that I knew that I could never feel comfortable there, and every day there is very hard for me, and I never feel safe. And that is what leads me to, it forces me to keep asking questions about it, because I have to figure out how do I deal with the tics in this minute so that I don't get worse and I don't make everyone else's experience here worse, and how do I deal with this minute in a way that the next minute will be better. And if I were at home lying on my couch or I was in a job where I was not exposed in this way, I don't think I would feel the urgency to keep trying to figure it out. And that's kind of why I'm there. I've sort of made my peace with where I'm at with it. I'm worse today at 35 years old than I was the worst times during the book. But I'm hoping that I can still figure something out and find something useful for somebody else down the road who doesn't have my perspective on it yet.
Isn't it exhausting to live in a state of hyper self-consciousness for that many hours a day?
You know, it really is. But again, you can get used to anything. You forget how good you can feel. And I'm sure you've got something like that in your life, and everyone listening does as well. We're always getting better at whatever we do. And so if I could go for a day without tics, or, you know, let's say a week, I'm sure I'd feel better than I do. But you can adapt to anything. So yes, it's exhausting, but yes, I'm used to it. If you tomorrow had to live a day like I do, your body would just be wrung out. A month from now, you'd get used to it.
Well, there was one point in the book where you went to see a man and actually stayed with him for a couple of weeks, and he taught you some techniques, including breathing, and it seemed like you did have some days where you didn't have a lot of tics.
You know, more than days, this was a man named Adam Glass, who was an Air Force tech sergeant, and he was stationed up in Minot, North Dakota. And Adam was the one who would originally get me into some of the strongman training that I do now. And I went up to see him because he was doing things nobody else could do. And so I wanted to learn how he could do them. And I would learn later that Adam had a brain injury during a riot. He was in the Air Force. And he got his brain injured during a riot in a prison in Iraq. And at that point, some things changed mentally with the way he saw things. And Adam would tell you he'd always been different, but that was when he started testing highly on the autism spectrum. And Adam didn't give me techniques. He gave me some questions, and he said, I want you to examine everything in your life and start recording everything you see. And he'd say, when do the tics get worse? And then I want you to see what happened before that and what happened after that. And then just see which things you can move around. He would say, stop looking for causes. Just look at everything as a sequence and then see if you can change the sequence at all. And this is what led me to some different ideas about breathing and the way lights affect me and the way certain foods affect me, and just on and on and on with about a million variables. And yeah, shortly after that visit with Adam, about 2 months later, I was able to sit still for 1 minute for the first time in seriously like 30 years of trying. And this started with the breathing. And over the next year, I would go for the better part of that year without really having any tics. So originally when I sold this book, it was going to be a book about how I had cured myself and then tried to figure out how to replicate it with some other people. And then during the writing of the book, after I had sold it, some different things happened and all the tics just roared back. And like I've said, at this point, I'm worse than I ever was. But I did have that year off. And so now what I have is a hope that I will once again find something that works, versus before I met Adam, where I just thought I had no choice but to wait it out. If that all sounds weird, it's because it is weird. And I'm still trying to make sense of it myself. But those are the broadest strokes in a way I can say them that actually do give you some idea of just how things progressed.
So you're not involved in any scientific studies or anything. You're just asking these questions of yourself.
Yeah, and honestly, in my early 20s, I joined a 10-year study a geneticist named Dr. McMahon was doing. And at the end of that 10 years, I was one of a couple of what they called true remitters, meaning I was exhibiting, for all practical intents and purposes, no symptoms. And I was feeling pretty sassy about all that. And then, you know, that was the time when I thought I'd cured myself. Yeah, and then it all just came back. So at this point, I don't know how much help I'd be in a study because I'm just back to being a very, very extreme case. And all they could do was look at me. Also, nobody's asking, so if anybody wanted me to be part of a study, I would happily do that. But not too interested in it on my own at this point.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Josh Hanna-Garney about his book titled The World's Strongest Librarian, a memoir of Tourette's, faith, strength, and the power of family. If you joined us late, you can listen to this entire program at The Right Question blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org. And while you're there, sign up for the podcast and click over to our Facebook page. We'll be back after a short break to talk about religion, Josh's struggle to finish college, and find out who Misty is. Don't go away. Do you think being raised in a Mormon family made a difference in how you've dealt with Tourette's?
Yeah, in some ways. I mean, and I think that would be true no matter how I'd been raised or who you were asking this question of. We're definitely the product of where we come from and who we are raised with. It did give me a safety net in some ways that in hindsight I think was damaging for me, because in the Mormon faith, the afterlife is a very specific thing. And everyone's going to be restored to perfection. You know, and in my case, that meant I would finally have muscular legs, and because my legs are really shrimpy, and I would finally be able to sit still. So in some ways, it made it feel less urgent to me during some of the worst years where I just couldn't figure out a way to go to school or to make myself hold a job. I could think, well, but all I have to do is make it through this life. And then think about how great it will be in the next one. And once I started questioning, well, what if that's not the case? What if this is all I get? There was a sense of urgency to maybe try to figure things out on my own, or at least make some progress that wasn't there before. You know, and the other thing was, if you're raised in any faith and you believe in a personal God, as I did, you tend to interpret the good things that happen to you as rewards, and the bad things that happen to you possibly as punishments or lessons or trials. And the fact that the Tourette's got so much worse when I was a missionary for the LDS Church, when I finally knew I was doing everything right in my life, that was when it went bad, that caused kind of a predictable crisis of faith. But again, other things, it... When you are raised Mormon, you learn that the body is inseparable from the soul, and this again, it impacted a lot of things about the way I look at my body and the way I believe I'm supposed to live.
I am curious about whether you went through a time of depression. I mean, I know after you came back from your mission that you spent some time recovering, but did you spend any time really, really blaming yourself for your Tourette's?
You know, probably at times partially, because Tourette's has a real mental component. I mean, it's not like I can't walk. It's not like I'm not able-bodied. It's not like my mind isn't agile and can't do all the things I wish it could do. I heard someone on a panel once say, sometimes a disability can be defined as an interruption in the experience of the normal user, or excuse me, the normal person. And to me, sometimes that's what Tourette's feels like. One of the things that can make it hard, besides just the wear and tear on the body and the pain, is if you're going to go outside and be around people, you have to be willing to be vulnerable and to risk being stared at and being judged and kind of losing the ability to make your own first impressions in some ways. What I tended to blame myself for was I was never positive that I shouldn't be handling it better than I was. Because on paper I could say, yes, I make these noises. Yes, I'm doing these things with my body. None of those things should make it so I can't go do school, so I can't go work. I just need to get tougher and do it. But telling somebody to toughen up doesn't automatically work, just like you can't go to a shy person and say, you know what, just be less shy, and suddenly that person is the life of the party.
Well, actually, there's a passage that, since you mentioned that, I'd like you to read. It's about when you were trying to go to school at Ricks College. But first, explain what you mean by MISTI. That's the name you've given to your symptoms.
Yeah, there was a point early on where I was, I think it was in junior high, and I was trying to tell my mom, I'm too embarrassed, it's too hard, I'm going to stay home from school that day. And she said, no, you can't let this thing make your decisions for you. This thing. And that was the first time I really thought of it as this other thing. And the more I thought of it, it just kind of evolved until it was this other person. And then I named it Miss Tourette's, and that became Miss T, and that just became MISTI. It kind of helped me to visualize it as being this other thing I could fight against. But also, since all I cared about was girls at the time, it evolved into a girl, and MISTI had red hair and green eyes. And suddenly this very attractive woman was, yes, following me around and hassling me. But I kind of gave it this other identity so that I could push against it and feel like I was fighting with someone specific because I'm very competitive. And so where would you like me to start?
I would like you to start on 25. College life at Ricks was fine. And then go over to page 127.
Okay. Ricks is in Rexburg, Idaho, and it's now called BYU, Idaho. College life at Ricks was fine, but I was surprised to find that going to church was one of the best parts. Every Sunday, everyone in my ward, a few hundred kids comprising a few apartment complexes, got dressed up and went to church to check one another out. It's an interesting experience to watch religious males try to outrighteous one another to catch the eye of the women. A bizarre bit of posturing, everyone trying to put the stud in Bible study. I got caught up in it, which was great for my spirituality. If our Sunday school class was going to be discussing the Book of Mormon, I'd better be ready, so I read. If we were going to do a service project, I'd be the first one there. I decided to major in philosophy. I really don't know why, except I liked the idea of myself thinking deep thoughts. It was kind of like when I decided to be a chess prodigy. It was more like I thought, you know, I'm the sort of person who should be a chess prodigy. But then I realized I had to practice and study chess matches, and so I quit. I liked the idea of Josh, the philosopher. I liked it so much that I enrolled in an ancient Greek class. MISTI didn't appreciate my studies. If I sat in the library, she had me shouting, then up and pacing around, trying to outdistance her with my lengthy stride. But she was a shadow that didn't fade with the sunset. And she wasn't merely attached to me at the heels. Every single cell in my body had a parasitic shade clinging to it. There were no depths or heights that I could descend or climb to in order to leave her behind. There was only the hope that she'd get distracted. "I'm really sorry, sir," said a voice that really and truly did sound really sorry. "Someone has complained about the noise. Is there anything I can—" I was studying for a Greek test. I had managed to escape into the middle little lexicon as I prepped for a frenzy of conjugations and translations the following morning. Suddenly, a hand on my shoulder. I was already up and gathering my things. "No, no, you're fine," I said. "I just meant it's not your fault. I can't help it, but it's not going to stop." I hadn't even known I was doing anything, and this was something new. I'd been absorbed in something and still having tics. Was nothing sacred to bellow cliches at the sky? "No, I had no idea it was happening," I told my mom on the phone that night. "Really?" "Yeah. Well, shoot." I lifted weights exactly one time that school year. It was a night when I was trying to study for a Book of Mormon class. Each time I tried to take a note, MISTI yanked my pen across the page. One page ripped, then another. And then the pen moved past the page, and now there was a big pen mark on my desk. I put on a sweatsuit and walked to the school's weight room. It was full of people. A big line of guys waiting to bench press, groups of girls talking and laughing, a bunch of people on treadmills, and me. Everyone looked like they had so much energy. The current medication made me slow and weak. "Ha!" I yelled. MISTI had followed me. Nobody looked. The room was full of grunting, so hopefully we'd go unnoticed. And maybe if I slapped my face, everyone would think I was just psyching myself up for a big lift. I went to the squat rack, which of course was not being used. Squats are hard, and legs aren't mirror muscles. I put 135 pounds on the bar. I put it on my shoulders, squatted down, and that was that. I couldn't stand back up. I sat down, letting the bar find the safety pins that were 3 feet off the ground. I rolled onto my side and crawled out of the rack. I noticed a couple of people watching. When I stood back up, my head swam. I couldn't stand to be weak, but having people see it was worse. I didn't go back.
But you did manage to finish school after many, many tries.
Yeah, it would be like another 6 years from that point.
And you are working in the library, and you're married, and you have children, but you still are questioning your Tourette's, what to do about it, if anything, and also your faith. You wrote a paragraph about where you are with your religious faith, at least when you finish the book, and it goes like this. I can't say there's not a God. I can't say there is. I can't say that I know the church is true. I can't say that I know it isn't. All I can say is that I don't know, and I don't know if it's possible to really know. Is that still where you are?
Yeah, I tried to leave it as soft as I could in the book because I don't. My family is all still very devout. At this point, I'm totally out. I'm not anti-religion. I'm not anti-Mormon in any way. What I feel like I have for the first time is some objectivity I didn't have as I was being raised. I feel like in some ways I was taught to believe. What is most important to me now is not to assume conclusions in advance, but to stay curious, and I want my opinions to evolve with new information. And right now, I feel like with this objectivity, I can just finally take a look at everything and try to figure out, what do I believe? Do I actually know why I believe it? And for now, that just has to be enough. It does not provide me any comfort. It doesn't seem to improve my understanding of the world or why I think I'm the way I am right now. And so I'm just asking and kind of fiddling around, and we'll see what happens. It may very well be that this newfound objectivity is what leads me back into this faith or another. I just don't know.
Well, you work in the right place to ask questions, to find answers.
Yeah, I hope so. That's part of it.
Do you have anything else that you wanted to say about the book?
You know, I love the book.
I do, too.
Oh, thank you. The response has been really positive.
Well, aside from learning about Tourette's and learning about what librarians have to put up with, it was a really enlightening and entertaining read. So thank you very much for writing it.
Oh, thank you. And if any of you are listening and you have Tourette's or you have somebody in your family with Tourette's, I hope you'll let me know. If I can help, I certainly will. And always happy at least to compare notes.
Josh Hanagarny lives and works in Salt Lake City, Utah. You'll find more information about him, as well as links to his website and reviews of his book at mtpr.org, which is where you'll also find links to our podcast and Facebook page.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.